Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Today is the 14th of November, 2013, across the dateline here in Japan. But today we're joined on the west coast of the United States by Lisa Pease, a longtime researcher on Cold War history and assassinations, who is an author of The Assassinations, Probe magazine on JFK, MLK, RFK, and Malcolm X, which is available through Amazon and other reputable online retailers. And she also has realhistoryarchives.blogspot.com. A blog that keeps track of various aspects of real history, including, of course, the JFK assassination. You can also find her on Twitter, twitter.com/LisaPease. That's P-E-A-S-E. All of that will, of course, be linked up in the show notes for this interview at CorbettReport.com. So, Lisa Pease, thank you for joining us today on the Corbett Report. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Excellent. Well, first of all, before we jump into today's topic, which is going to be the interesting life story of Lee Harvey Oswald and what we actually know about him, perhaps we can start just with a brief introduction about yourself and how you came to be interested in this and some of the research that you've done along these lines over the years.
Sure. I had no interest in the case until right around the time of Oliver Stone's film, but I didn't actually see the film for maybe a year after until it had been out. I had found a book at a garage sale, and it happened to be Jim Garrison's book, On the Trail of the Assassins. And it was so well written and so fascinating, and I'm like, wow, this makes a really compelling case that the CIA killed President Kennedy. And I'm like, why have I never heard this before? What is the evidence for that? And, you know, I was intrigued, but I didn't, and I knew a little bit about the CIA from the Iran-Contra stuff that had been in the news, and, you know, but I just didn't know that much. And then soon after that, the internet went public in its very early form, before there were web pages. This is back in the days of Gopher, and, you know, people may not even know that term anymore, and FTP sites. And, you know, my first web page was actually hosted off an FTP site. But my first internet search ever was JFK assassination, just because I happened to be reading about it at the time. And I landed in the group Alt Conspiracy JFK, where a very rabid discussion of the Kennedy assassination was transpiring. And, you know, I jumped in, you know, thinking I knew a lot and realized just how little I did know. Because, you know, you read one or two books, you are not an expert. You read 10 or 20 books, you're still not an expert. You know, you read the hundreds and hundreds of pages of files and, you know, thousands of pages maybe. Now you're starting to become an expert. You know, so it really takes time if you really want to learn about this case. It's easy to get an overview from any of a number of books. But it took me 20 years to learn what I've learned. And some things you learn and you kind of don't believe them at first, and then they either prove true or not true. And you have to keep reading, because, again, just because it's in a book, especially just because it's in a book ostensibly labeled nonfiction, doesn't mean it's true. There's a lot of crop out there in supposedly nonfiction books.
Absolutely. And, of course, for people out there who haven't really delved too much into the JFK assassination, I mean, it really is overwhelming. And this is why I am firmly a novice and will likely remain that way, because I've only been deeply looking into it for a few years. And that's really not enough to really get much of anything other than a broad overview of some of the key details. And I know that you really can get lost into this for decades, because there has been so much information that's been put out there over the years, and we've learned certain things, and then certain things that seem to be true turned out not to be true, and all of this. So you paint a good picture, I think, of what the assassination research community is like. And it's interesting that you yourself came into it around the time of the release of Stone's JFK, because that time, I'm still relatively young. I was only a boy of 12 years old at the time, so I did see the movie, and I think that probably contributed to my, as far as I can remember, lifelong opinion that JFK was not killed by a lone nut. But I really don't have any sense of what it was like for the general public, especially in America, as I'm Canadian, in the years prior to JFK's, to Oliver Stone's JFK. And perhaps from your own perspective, you can tell us what the general sentiment that you had experienced in your life prior to the release of that movie had been amongst the general public.
Right. And I won't say this from my own personal experience, just because I never really talked to anybody about it until around that time, you know, outside of immediate family, a couple of passing comments. But I will say that the polls show that Right after the, shortly after the Warren Commission report came out, people were believing there had been a conspiracy by more than 50%. And then after the critics got started and a lot of the facts came out, that shot up to about 80%, and it's hovered around that level ever since. There seems to be a slight decline in recent years, but it just depends on which poll you're looking at. And but there's never been a point in time where less than 50% of the American public has believed, that it wasn't a conspiracy, meaning the majority has always believed it was a conspiracy. And when I talk to people, because it's always fun, where were you when Kennedy was killed and what were your impressions of that weekend? Because it was the first live news event, people in different generations, pretty much everybody alive and listening today probably remembers where they were on 9/11. That was one of those seminal events with that nonstop media coverage and all these weird questions. And, it's one of those things that's just seared into your memory. Well, the Kennedy assassination was like that for the older generation. They all know where they were, or at least almost all. There are a few high-profile political people who, for whatever reason, can't remember where they were. They're just always But never mind that. But it's a compelling case, especially because Oswald was killed. Here you've got this guy arrested who says, hey, I'm just a patsy. He actually says that on TV while the cameras are rolling. And then he's killed the next day. I don't know the exact time frame. I'd have to go back and look. I don't remember when he made that comment. But, within a couple of days, he's dead on national TV, shot while in police custody. And I think that's when a lot of people, at least the ones I've talked to, have said that's when they thought it must be a conspiracy, because clearly they felt he had been silenced. And I think that's a pretty accurate observation after my 20 years of research.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, that's one of the things that really stands out first and foremost. If this was some crazed communist who was doing this for some political reason, why did he, in the only chance really he had to speak to the public during his time of incarceration, why did he say, I am just a patsy? Why didn't he try to take credit for what he had supposedly done? I mean, that's just one of the many, many things. But let's get into this, because I really think to this day, this is still the heart of the mythos of the JFK assassination as it's come down to us, is this story of Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone nut, which is on its face ridiculous for so many reasons. But I think a lot of the public don't even really understand how ridiculous it is, this story that they want us to believe, the official story of Lee Harvey Oswald. So today I want to start exploring that story with you a little bit. And I want to go back to Lee Harvey Oswald's youth and what we can piece together about his time as a youngster growing up in Louisiana, and some of the influences he had, and how that might have contributed to the picture that was painted of him and who he really did become. Again, this is all quite confusing, but perhaps you can set some of that background with us and tell us a little bit about Lee Harvey Oswald.
Let me just start by giving kind of the official version, the Warren Report version, just so you can see the contrast. So according to the Warren Report, Oswald had kind of an unhappy childhood, an overbearing mother, had problems in school, lied about his age to join the Marine Corps a year sooner than he would have been able to, had some problems there, ended up being let go with a dishonorable discharge. Bear in mind, almost none of what I'm saying is true the way it sounds. There are pieces of truth in it, but again, the official story. So anyway, then he goes into the Marine Corps, supposedly dishonorable discharge, and then supposedly defects to Russia, and then gets disenchanted with that because it wasn't everything he thought it was cracked up to be, comes back to America, kind of becomes a self-proclaimed leader of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in New Orleans, passes out flyers in support of it, gets into arguments with people on the street who we later find out were CIA people, but I'll come back to that. And then for no particular reason, because here's this supposed leftist communist who had fairly mild communist views. He made a point of saying, I'm not a communist, I'm a Marxist-Leninist. And, if you understand them, there is a distinction. And, it's interesting he even knew enough to know there was a distinction and to paint that. So again, here's the supposed leftist who then kills a leftist president, a Democrat, a liberal. And, you know, a little hard to believe. And they called him a loner, even though he had friends, he had a wife, he had kids, you know, kind of an odd loner. And not only that, his friends all happened to be, shall we say, very conservative, right-wing, reactionary types. So, again, a very odd story. So let's go back and look at maybe the real story of who Oswald was. All right. He did have a strange childhood in the sense that his mother had been remarried and divorced, and one of her husbands had died, and she had at times left the kids. And he had two brothers, one a half-brother and one a full-brother, and the mother had at times left them in an orphanage and then come pick them up again. And I guess that was like daycare, I guess, for the poor. I don't know. you know, he did join the Marine Corps because he had an older brother in it who encouraged him, and it's kind of, I guess, the thing that kids were doing it that day. He joined this thing called the Civil Air Patrol, which is kind of like, how do I want to say it? Kind of, you know, basically like Air Force training for kids. They get to fly planes and, you know, learn a little bit about security. And the group that he joined was run by this very odd character named David Ferry, in New Orleans, who, again, was on the fringe of a lot of CIA activity. He was very involved in the Bay of Pigs effort in terms of fundraising and pulling arms together. You know, when, how do I want to say, there's the CIA employees, that's kind of the first level of CIA, and then there are the people the CIA works with directly, but that are not employees of the agency that they directly contract with. That's kind of like CIA level two. And then some of those contractors in turn become handlers for other people who are now, you know, two levels removed from the agency, you know, maybe CIA level three. To me, they're all CIA in the sense that, bottom line, they're all working for the agency. They're all serving it. So in that sense, I say that Ferry was CIA, but he was not an employee of the CIA. But he was working directly with people who were working with CIA employees to fund these efforts, to fly planes. I met a CIA pilot who talked about what a great pilot Ferry was, and he had a reputation for being able to land a plane on a, you know, bare bones beach. Anyway, so this is the guy Oswald is learning from. And it was Ferry, I guess, who encouraged him to join the Marines early as well. So he's kind of in it thick. I will also add as one anecdote, I know somebody in my own life who had been in the Civil Air Patrol as a kid who was asked to join the CIA while he was in the Civil Air Patrol. So I guess it's, you know, proof that it could have been a recruiting ground. It was for this guy that I knew. I don't know if that's what happened with Oswald or not. I will say that he loved watching the show, the TV show here called I Led Three Lives, about a spy. He read spy books at the library. I mean, this was a kid who was very interested in that world. So, anyway, he goes to the Marines, and his fellow Marines call him Oswaldovich because he goes around openly professing his love for all things Russian. He plays Russian operas out of his tent, and he speaks Russian and, you know, does all these kind of pro-communist things. Now, again, remember, this is the Cold War. This is just after the McCarthy era. You know? Actually, it's kind of in the middle of the McCarthy era, if you think about it. I mean, this is Red Scare territory, and you're in the Marines, and you're acting like a communist. Why didn't they just throw him out? Well, I think it's obvious that everybody just assumed he was some sort of an intelligence asset, you know, playing, you know, with his cover and, you know, developing himself for what would come in the future. And in his immediate future, he ended up being a radar operator in Japan. And the flights that he was tracking were U-2 flights, again, top secret CIA planes. So the Warren Commission tried to downplay his clearance level, but he had to have a higher level of clearance than the Warren Commission officially acknowledged. And some of the people who knew him in the military said that had to be the case because of the flights that he was tracking. He not only tracked the U-2 flights over the Soviet Union, which everybody knew about, he was also tracking, we now know, thanks to the ARB, he was tracking secret U-2 flights over China that hadn't been acknowledged publicly at that time. Super secret stuff. All right, so, I mean, this guy is very connected. All right, when he leaves the military, he gets an honorable discharge. It's not until he's out of the military for a while that it's changed to a dishonorable discharge, which he then tried to get reversed. And I don't know if he knew why that had been changed or what, but it's been very much fuzzed over in his record. And he seems to have studied Russian at this special language school for the intelligence community that's kind of mentioned in passing in the Warren Commission, but again, fuzzed over. Anything intelligence related is fuzzed over. And again, some of the files that we've had released since Oliver Stone's JFK film show that the CIA and the FBI were both kind of negotiating on what they were going to say about who Oswald was. And James Angleton literally fretted for 6 months waiting to see whether Hoover was going to say Oswald was an agent of the CIA. And, you know, basically the CIA was pressing the FBI not to say that. And it looks like, you know, the CIA had the upper hand on Hoover because in the end, Hoover didn't say that. But again, so here's this guy who clearly has some intelligence connections. He gets a flight to Europe, and the Warren Commission tries to track how he pays for it. Well, he doesn't have any money to pay for this long flight that goes, you know, through Switzerland and then on to Finland. And they never could explain, you know, which flights he took, how he paid for it. And the fact that he went to Finland to get into the Soviet Union is also significant because it's one of the few places where you can get in very quickly. A lot of times it takes weeks to get a passport into Russia at that point in time, especially for a so-called civilian. You can't just like walk up to the border, show a passport and walk through a highly closed society. But in Finland, Oswald goes there. He stays at what is the equivalent of like the Ritz-Carlton. So this poor kid with no money, you know, somehow gets this flight and ends up at like a 5-star hotel and then gets into the Soviet Union the very next day. I mean, all of these circumstances make no sense if he's who the Warren Report say he is. But they make perfect sense if he's an intelligence agent on assignment. And again, as far as the various levels of intelligence agents, one of the things that CIA people did was run singleton operations, meaning you weren't part of a team, you weren't part of a group. Some CIA agent basically ran you on a personal basis, kind of out of their back pocket. And another CIA person who was in that category, Jerry Patrick Hemming, who for the most part I don't consider very credible, but I do think he was credible on this point. He did say that James Jesus Angleton, the head of the CIA's counterintelligence for 25 years, was running singleton operations into the Soviet Union. All right. We also know the CIA at that time was running a false defector program. Because again, I mean, just on the face of it, who wants to defect from free America to closed society, dictatorship, you know, communist KGB, you know, USSR at that point in time? No one in their right mind would choose to leave the free country of America to go live in a closed society. It just doesn't happen. And the Soviets knew that. So every time one of these defectors arrived, the Soviets would talk to them, figure they were CIA spooks, try and get whatever information they could out of them, and eventually send them back. Oswald was kind of in the middle of a pack of American so-called defectors who went over there. And again, the Warren Commission just tells us flat out he defected. John Newman, on the other hand, a former intelligence analyst, went through the actual files, every single thing on Oswald, and he pointed out to the rest of us, he's like, hey, Oswald never actually defected. He would have had to sign this, he would have had to do that, and he specifically didn't. So he claimed to defect, but he didn't really defect. He never gave up his U.S. citizenship. And then I noticed, even in the Warren Commission documents, how did he get back from the Soviet Union? He came back on a military hop. So again, we have this guy who supposedly, you know, he probably worked on the base where the U-2 flights were flying. He had top secret information, goes to the Soviet Union, says he's going to defect, and yet he's still welcomed back to America, not only with open arms, but on a military flight. He gets a loan from the State Department when he gets back. I mean, it's incredible on the face of it if the official story is true. But again, if he's an intelligence agent, none of this is crazy. All of this makes perfect sense. And while Oswald was in Russia, he wrote this long, they called it a diary, and it's really not a diary. It's kind of an interesting little document. He's describing the buildings that he sees. He's describing fields where tanks are laid out. He's describing, you know, various communication structures. Again, when former defense intelligence analyst John Newman looked at that, he goes, this is what we would call a realities report, that the Soviet, the CIA would send people into the Soviet Union and just have them describe and try and build up a picture of the country from the outside. They didn't have, they couldn't take film cameras in. They couldn't necessarily take too many pictures, certainly couldn't do casing kind of pictures without being noticed. But they could write, and they could write these innocuous things. And so Oswald comes up, and he has his diary retyped from his handwritten notes. I don't know how many of you write a diary and then take it to somebody else and have it retyped?
Yeah.
I think no one does that. But again, if this is his intelligence report, of course he has it retyped so that people can actually read his notes. And then when he comes back to America, he gets a job at this company called Jagger's Child Stovall. And one of the things they did was process U-2 spy plane photos, especially the stuff over Cuba that the CIA was taking at the time. In his address book, there's an entry from microdots, which is a spy technique of taking a page and shrinking it down to the size of a period and sticking it in a document as a period and then taking it to another facility where it can be blown up and read as the full-size document. Think Adobe PDF. You can PDF something really big down to a really tiny size, but then you open the PDF and you can zoom way in and see it, and you're not losing resolution. So that's kind of like what the early microdot technology was like. So everything about Oswald's life is just screaming CIA spy. And anyway, so now we go to the CIA side of it, and we look at the files that they had on Oswald during this time. Because again, if he's not a spy, and yet he has all this information on the CIA's U-2 program, and he's truly defecting to the Soviet Union, wouldn't you expect alarm bells to be going off? Wouldn't you expect the CIA would have instantly opened an investigation into him and tried to send a spy into Russia to knock him off before he could give secrets to the, the Soviets? It is interesting to note that there was a U-2 flight that went down over the Soviet Union during the time that Oswald was there. Francis Gary Powers was the pilot, and he managed to, escape and eject, and he lived. And he wrote years later, he always wondered if maybe Oswald had tipped off the Soviets. And if people believe Powers, and if Oswald did, why would Oswald do that? Well, Eisenhower was about to have a peace summit with the Soviets, and when the plane went down, that sabotaged the peace summit. So some have speculated that the flight was deliberately sabotaged by the CIA in order to prevent the peace summit from happening, which in a rearview mirror would actually make a lot of sense. The CIA's entire existence was predicated on the Cold War continuing. Had peace, been formed at that point in time, there was no new enemy on the horizon, the CIA would have been cut way back, and they knew that. And it would make sense that they would try and preserve it. Now, whether Oswald really had any part of that, I have no idea. I've never seen any solid evidence on that. It's just one of those provocative what if could have been, but that doesn't prove anything. But the fact that the plane went down is interesting. The Soviets claim they shot it down. The CIA originally said that they'd had a malfunction, and they gave two or three different stories of what happened, which makes me think the CIA was responsible for the downing of the plane and not the Soviets. The CIA doesn't open a file on its defector, and they should have. And yet, a year later, a guy over at the State Department is looking at these guys who went to the Soviet Union trying to figure out, are any of them real defectors or are they all CIA people? And so this guy, Otto Achepka, sends a list of names to the CIA and says, what do you have on these guys? Well, the list is divided up, and some names are sent to one part of the CIA, and a few names are pulled aside and sent to a very different part of the CIA. Oswald was in that much smaller set, and when the request came in, somebody at CIA already knew what to do with Oswald. He wasn't on the general list. He was on a very special list. Within Angleton's counterintelligence empire, which housed 200 employees, he had a very tiny group of about 10, his very special secret mole hunting unit, his black ops group, and that's where Oswald's file was. And people knew that. When the Oswald name came through, somebody recognized it and said, oh, that needs to go to CIA SIG. And so at that point, For the first time, finally, an official 201 file is opened on Oswald. And again, from the documents released, John Newman, who's done the best work, I think, his book Oswald and the CIA is must reading, but it's really not for beginners. I'd say get a grounding in the case first. But he does a very detailed trace of all these files. And he noticed that in the 201 file that was opened in 1959, after he had defected, you know, almost a year later, he found some files that were like handwritten notes from 1957, which hinted obviously then at the existence of an earlier file. So it seems like there might have been a secret file in Oswald before that time, but at this time there became an official, probably a dummy CI file set up on Oswald to house his future history. And everything that happens in that Oswald file is very interesting from this point on, you know, because he comes back, he, you know, moves to New Orleans, and like I said, he gets involved with these anti-Castro demonstrators, and it turns out that the group, which I'll call by their initials, the DRE, it's actually a Cuban name, and I'm sure I will mispronounce it, but that was a group that was run and sponsored by the CIA, as were nearly all the anti-Castro groups all over the country at that time. The CIA was so hell-bent on getting at Castro, and the Cubans knew this, that pretty much, you know, an easy way to get funds is just say you were an anti-Castro group, and the CIA would come knocking and say, how can we help? So anyway, the DRE was run by one man in particular, this guy George Joannidis, who's very interesting because when there was a reinvestigation of the Warren Commission in the 70s, a man named George Joannidis stepped in to shut down the HSCA's investigation of the CIA. Dan Hardway, who I was just at a conference with in Pittsburgh recently, talked about, you know, what had happened. Originally, Dan Hardway and Eddie Lopez had been given full access to CIA. They got to see unredacted files. They got to just look at anything they wanted. Anything they requested was to be provided. This was an actual investigation, and the CIA was complying, but they started getting too close to the center of the operation, it appears. They were getting real close to some high-profile bad guys who show up a lot in the Kennedy story. And so George Joannidis comes in and shuts them down, essentially, and goes to Blakey and says, you can't have what you've had in the past. You have to, you know, now do it this way. We're going to redact the files before you see them, unless it's, you know, if you want to insist on seeing it, one guy can come and see it in our special room, but you can't take the files out with you. You can't take the notes out with you. I mean, it's just crazy the restrictions these guys had to operate under. And Joannidis never told any of them that he was, in fact, in a way, a suspect in the case because he had been running this group that had directly interacted with Oswald that was part of the, if you will, the framing of Oswald as this rabid communist type, because that DRE group then put him on a debate on TV and, you know, where he got to talk about being a Marxist-Leninist. And, you know, right after the assassination of Kennedy, that tape was shown that on TV. It's like, oh, look at this guy. And America was so naive when the assassination went down. They truly had no idea that of what the CIA did for the most part. There hadn't been any big exposés on the CIA at the time of the Kennedy assassination. A lot of people, you know, kind of knew we had one, didn't really know what they did. It was all very hush-hush. It wasn't until the year after the assassination that the first book that came out that was a little bit critical of the agency was published. And it was called The Invisible Government, which is a pretty strong statement. And so that's, I think, why the Warren Commission was able to get away with all this myth-making about who Oswald was, because the public didn't know any better. But after that book came out, then in 1966, the New York Times did an actually remarkable expose of a bunch of CIA operations that had kind of run amok, and they talked about one in particular that Kennedy found out about after the fact and was furious about, which proved that the CIA was initiating its operations and not the president. That's always the line in America. Oh, the CIA answers to the president. They serve at the pleasure of the president. They never do things the president doesn't order. that is fiction. That is simply not true. And the New York Times was amazingly brave and bold in 1966 and told a story about a sugar shipment that was leaving Cuba that the CIA had tainted so that it would make people sick. And Kennedy heard about this, and he was furious. And so he got some of his more loyal guys together and a couple of CIA operatives who are on his side, and they ran a counter-operation against their own CIA to prevent that sugar from leaving the harbor. I mean, it's just an incredible story that's never talked about. And I mentioned it to David Talbot, and it appears in his book, Brothers, which is a really good book about the Kennedy brothers. It's about John Kennedy's death and Robert Kennedy's investigation into it, which is another little told story. But in any way, it's very clear as you study the Oswald story, it's very clear in retrospect with all that we know about the CIA, how they work. I've read, you know, just about every history of the CIA written. It's clear to me that Oswald was being run as a singleton, a little off-the-books agent, to do, you know, little dirty deeds or whatever. And I don't know how much Oswald did. I don't know if Oswald knew he worked for the CIA. I think he did. But it's possible he didn't. On the CIA file cover sheets, there are things called witting collaborators and unwitting collaborators. I've never seen that sheet for Oswald, so I don't know if he was witting or unwitting. I think he was smart enough, he would have suspected, at least, and I think he was probably witting. But we just don't know, because that sheet is not in his file. It is in the file of a woman who interviewed him when he was in the Soviet Union, this woman, Priscilla Johnson McMillan, who still appears on all these TV documentaries about the case, despite the fact that her file lists her as a witting collaborator with the CIA. So again, not a CIA employee per se, but somebody who's doing the bidding of the agency and knows it. And, you know, so I get so frustrated when I see all these TV specials, because clearly the CIA is the top suspect for who killed Kennedy, given the way they were involved in Oswald's life. And to have CIA people come out and tell us Oswald acted alone is very self-serving. You know, it's like asking a criminal to, you know, or giving a criminal the chance to say, I didn't do it, and then taking him at his word. You know?
It's almost as ridiculous as appointing Alan Dulles to the Warren Commission. But, yeah.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Alan Dulles had been running the CIA. He'd been running much more than the CIA. Alan Dulles and his brother had been running America's foreign policy, you know, for the country more than the president, you know, ever since Eisenhower was elected. In fact, Alan Dulles had worked really hard with Dewey. Remember that famous headline, Dewey wins? Well, that was Alan Dulles' guy, and he lost to Truman, you know, in a dead heat, basically. So Alan Dulles' reign was delayed a few years. But when Eisenhower was elected, he appointed Alan Dulles at CIA and his brother, John Foster Dulles, at State. And together, they controlled all our overt and covert foreign policy. And they synced up at times, and at times in ways that Eisenhower didn't know. One of the great untold stories that no one has talked about in this country, but it's been written about in other countries, was the Suez Crisis. And how Alan Dulles helped set up, how do I want to say, the Israel, like, stage an invasion of Suez. And then the British, and I think the French, came in to put down the Israeli invasion, but that was the British and French excuse to take over the Suez Canal. I mean, it's just this horrible fake operation, false flag operation, you know, because really they were in cahoots with Israel the whole time. You know, but they made, you know, it was like a good cop, bad cop routine, you know, and Israel was bad cop coming in, and then the good cops came in to take care of the bad cop. But in reality, they were trying to steal the Suez from Egypt. And Alan Dulles was supportive of this coup, and so was John Foster Dulles. The person who wasn't supportive, Dwight D. Eisenhower, the president, and he found out, he's like, what the hell? This is wrong. Give the Swiss back. You can't take that away. And to me, that just shows that the split between the CIA and the presidency predates Kennedy. This isn't new to Kennedy. These are the people who came out of the banking establishment. Alan Dulles had been part of, I think, the Treaty of Versailles. I mean, these families were deeply embedded in what we call the establishment, you know, the you know, people like to say the Bilderbergers, the Illuminati. It's much more, how do I want to say, nebulous than that. If only we could point to a single group and say that's them. But it's ever changing because it's all about power and money and who's got what at that particular point in time. It's amorphous. But Dulles, both Dulleses, had a lot of power in the previous century, right up until John Foster's death and, of course, Alan Dulles's firing from the CIA. So, again, here you have Kennedy's killed, probably by the CIA, and then the guy that Kennedy fired who headed the CIA, who very likely was involved in the plot from outside the CIA, is now brought in to basically, you know, be a part of the Warren Commission. And that's one of the biggest lies ever told, is that it was the quote-unquote Warren Commission, because Earl Warren did not participate very much. Earl Warren kind of knew it was a sham. Earl Warren didn't even want to participate. He was forced into it by Lyndon Johnson, who tried to convince him that there probably was a conspiracy, but it probably involved the Soviets, and he didn't want to go to war, and so it was necessary to have a cover-up. And again, we have these transcripts of these conversations. That's basically how LBJ got Warren to serve on it. But Warren didn't show up for a lot of the testimony. The guy who put in the most time on the Warren Commission was Alan Dulles. We really should call it the Alan Dulles Commission.
That would be more appropriate for a number of reasons. But returning to the story of Oswald, I want to talk a little bit about his employment once he returned to the United States, because he ends up working in a couple of, well, interesting locations. Of course, the Texas School Book Depository. But before that, the Riley Coffee Company in New Orleans. Perhaps you can talk a little bit about his employment there.
Yeah, the Riley Coffee Company is interesting because, Oswald... I'm going to have to jump here for a minute. There's a wonderful book called Thy Will Be Done that talks, it's kind of a parallel history of the Rockefeller family, the CIA's history, and how the two joined together to overthrow the countries of South America using Christianity to pacify the natives so they wouldn't revolt than when they came in and stole their land and ran railroads through and took their resources. And they taught them, you know, all authority comes from God, and, you know, if you're poor, that's noble. And, you know, it's a kind of a horrifying book that asks the question at the end, is it thy will be done or thy will be done, you know, to God's will or thy will. But in this book, they talk about a coffee company in New Orleans who I strongly suspect was Riley, that was actually shipping guns to these CIA-sponsored rebellions in Latin America in coffee canisters. And I can't help but wonder if that's part of what Oswald was doing. If one coffee company in New Orleans was doing that, probably more than one coffee company was doing that. And Oswald was known to have an interest in guns, and, you know, that company was kind of near a nexus of intelligence assets. So it's just kind of an interesting place for Oswald to have been working, again, with Jagger's Child Stovall, where the U2 maps were processed. I mean, all of Oswald's jobs seem to have this kind of hint of intelligence connection to them. So, at some point, of course, Oswald leaves New Orleans and then goes to Dallas and gets involved with the Paines. Ruth Paine and Michael Paine welcome Marina and Oswald into their household. Ruth says, you know, she's just fascinated by all things Russian and wants to practice her Russian with Marina. And so they supposedly become fast friends. Little known fact, Ruth Paine's father worked for the CIA. Ruth Paine's mother, I believe, and I would have to check my data on this, but I think she was friends with Mary Bancroft, who was one of the people Alan Dulles, one of Alan Dulles' paramours, essentially, was cheating on his wife with, to put it bluntly. So it wouldn't surprise me if Ruth Paine herself had some direct connection to Alan Dulles. That hasn't surfaced, but she's one or two steps away. Then the Paines take them in, and then they seem to try and split up their marriage. You know, it's Ruth wants to hang out with Marina. Michael Paine tries to get Oswald alone. It's a very unseemly sort of thing that's happening there, something odd going on. And it's actually Ruth Paine who suggests that Oswald gets the job at the Texas Book Depository. And you know, I'll call somebody, you know, I'll help you. And so then he gets this job at the depository, and I don't remember from the timing. I just don't remember if Kennedy's visit had been announced by that time or not when he got the job. But it wasn't long before or long after. It was around that time, but I don't remember the exact sequence. So then you have Oswald working at the book depository the day of the assassination, which is important because after the assassination, when he's arrested, the police test him for nitrate. When you fire a gun, when you fire a rifle, little bits of nitrate shoot out of the gun, and they're tiny particles that embed in your skin such that it's difficult to wash off. I mean, if you really scrubbed hard and you sweated hard for a day, you know, you could get all the particles out. But if you just, like, washed your hands, splashed your face, you know, rubbed your face, you'd have a hard time removing all the nitrate. Well, the police found there was nitrate on Oswald's hands, but there was no nitrate on his cheek, which is where you'd expect it from the rifle. Because anything, here's the problem, anything can give you nitrate on your hands, a huge variety of substances like clay pots, tennis shoes, cardboard boxes. And what was Oswald's job? Moving cardboard boxes at the book depository. So of course he had nitrate on his hands. The police tried to say that proved he fired a gun. No, it didn't. It just proved he worked with cardboard all day. That's all that proved. But very suspicious was the fact that Oswald had no nitrate on his cheek. The FBI knew right away this was a problem. So they actually sent the test out for a much more sensitive test. All right, the police did the regular test and couldn't find nitrate. So the FBI went and did neutron activation analysis tests on it to try and find minute particles of nitrate, and they still came up empty. And then the FBI thought, you know, well, maybe the gun doesn't give off nitrate. So they had their agents fire his gun. And when their agents fired Oswald's gun, it gave off so much nitrate, they got both cheeks were covered with nitrate. And yet Oswald had none. And so, you know, the FBI told the Warren Commission. Redlich, one of the commission lawyers, wrote a note to Alan Dulles saying there's no basis for concluding that Oswald fired a rifle. And guess what? That was just ignored. It's right there. It's in their documents. It's not in the report, but it's in their documents. But, you know, it was reported as well. You know, we proved that Oswald fired a gun. So the FBI did do one thing. They said, well, we have to come up and show there's a way to have a false negative. You know, false positive is what you get if you handle cardboard. It's a false positive. It's positive for nitrate, but it's false for firing a gun. You know, so they need to construct some scenario to give you a false negative. And this, again, is right there in Cortland Cunningham's testimony. Anyone can go read this in the Warren report. And no one does. People quote part of it and they don't read the whole thing, or they're lying to you. Because what Cortland Cunningham describes is the way they got a false negative was by using two people, not one. One guy cleans the gun and loads it, and then he hands it to the shooter and the guy who cleaned and loaded, I think, is even holding the gun while the shooter pulls the trigger. So he fires, and then he hands it back, and the gun is again cleaned and loaded by a second person between shots. And that is the only scenario where they got a false negative. And yet that is used to say, see, Oswald could have had a false negative. Never mentioning that, well, then Oswald also must have had a partner, which would mean a conspiracy. So I know for a fact that Oswald did not fire a rifle that day. And once you know that, then it gets even more interesting, because here the CIA has been working with him and sending him up all along. Why would they frame one of their own? Well, that goes into, possibly, there were a couple of informants, or there was one particular informant to a plot that had happened 3 weeks earlier in Chicago. There was a plot to kill Kennedy that was remarkably similar. Kennedy's car was supposed to make this turn. There were a team of shooters, you know, in this one little area, and there was one guy who had a background very similar to Oswald's, kind of a disgruntled ex-Marine, if you believe it on the face of it. Very similar story. Well, the informant who tipped off the Secret Service to this plot was somebody whose name was reported only as Lee. Don't know if it was Lee Harvey Oswald. but that would be a good enough reason to make him the patsy in Dallas if he's the guy tipping off your plot in some other city.
Well, so perhaps this might be a good time for me to interject, because this is something I wanted to bring up with you at some point, is you mentioned earlier, of course, LBJ trying to persuade Earl Warren to head up and give his imprimatur to the Warren Commission, despite his reluctance to do so. And one of the ways he did that was by saying, well, this was probably a communist conspiracy, but we have to convince the public that it was Oswald acting alone, otherwise we could have war. This is something that has only recently occurred to me as I was rewatching a Fletcher Prouty interview recently, and I can't believe it's never occurred to me before, but it seems that one way of interpreting what happened is that obviously, I mean, there's no doubt that Hoover and LBJ actively participated in the cover-up of what happened, and they were knowing, witting cover-up agents from the point of the assassination onwards. Some people go from that and try to say that that Hoover and LBJ were in fact actually behind the plot, which I think is a much shabbier case, and there's a lot less evidence for that. But something that has occurred to me is that LBJ stepping into the role of president, which of course had just so recently been vacated by someone who had his head blown off in broad daylight, ostensibly
in front of him, in the car in front of him.
Exactly. Well, and ostensibly for standing up to these insane people in the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the CIA and other positions in the invisible government that were that had been repeatedly attempting to get the United States involved with in armed conflict with Cuba and with the Soviet Union generally, because they believe they had first strike advantage and wanted to make use of it.
Right.
It seems to me that LBJ might have realized that Oswald was being set up as the patsy precisely because he had this Soviet connection, he had these Cuban connections. It was the perfect setup from the CIA or the Joint Chiefs of Staff position to basically blame this on the communists and to start that war that they'd been going for. So it may have been interpreted as a type of ultimatum whereby LBJ is in the position where either you give us the war in Vietnam, which he obviously did, going along with the further involvement of Vietnam and the Gulf of Tonkin and all of that as it unfolded, as we now know. You either give us that, or you give us the Cuban-Soviet, or we'll take the Cuban-Soviet invasion that we've been going for so long. I don't know. I mean, obviously, this is complete speculation, but it seems to me that's at least one...
interesting. Yeah, it's a very interesting speculation, and it's definitely not out of the realm of possibility. Yeah, I've not seen any evidence for that, but it would make sense. It's not, like I said, it's not a crazy theory. That's a very interesting theory. And there is evidence, of course, that LBJ knew that something was wrong with the whole Oswald story, because there's that conversation that's transcribed between him and Hoover where they talk about somebody impersonating, you know, Oswald down in Mexico City, an event that happened a month before the assassination. That's also really interesting because it looks like, again, the CIA was setting up, supposedly the CIA, you know, somebody, either Oswald or somebody who pretends to be Oswald, goes to the Soviet embassy and the Cuban embassy in Mexico City a month before the assassination and says they want to go get into Cuba. Can I get a visa to Cuba? The Cubans say no, but try the Russians, or I forget which way it went, or the Russians say no, but try the Cubans, and ostensibly goes to both embassies and is denied on both counts. We know for a fact that some of those conversations had to be false, because again, John Newman traced who was working at the embassy, which days, what hours they were open, when they were closed, and at least one of the conversations happened when no one was around. There was actually a big event that day and everybody was out somewhere else. So one of the conversations was entirely fictitious. The problem at the Cuban embassy is that the Cuban consul, who he talked to, a man named Azq, described him as a short, blonde guy, not the guy that we saw in Dallas, you know, not a dark-haired guy. And so, you know, again, begging the question of who was there posing as Oswald and why. And clearly, going to your speculation, clearly the goal was to at least make it look like Oswald was doing this on behalf of the Soviet Union or Cuba. If he'd actually gotten into Cuba, then they could have argued, or probably would have argued, that he was coming back to kill Kennedy on behalf of Castro. Now, he didn't get into Cuba. Whoever it was, you know, wasn't allowed in. So maybe that plan was thwarted. But even so, right after the assassination, what do we find out years later? a whole bunch of assets of one guy in the CIA named David Atlee Phillips started filling the news with all these stories suggesting Castro did it. And at the HSCA, the House Select Committee on Assassinations that reinvestigated the case in the 70s for Congress, they actually traced all these authors of these pro-Castro articles and found they all were assets of this one CIA guy named David Atlee Phillips, who another CIA asset said he had seen with Lee Harvey Oswald, again, about a month before the assassination. So it's really interesting to me that it's both Cuba and the Soviet Union that are blamed separately, because there were warring factions inside the CIA. There was a James Angleton faction that really wanted to blame the assassination on the Soviets and, as you say, use that as an excuse to go have a first strike and all-out war with them. There was a separate faction that really wanted to blame it on Cuba and Castro, and that might be why we have the kind of schizophrenic disinformation campaign. The CIA couldn't even agree amongst themselves who the ultimate culprit would be. And in the end, of course, it didn't matter as long as it wasn't them. I call all the theories, you know, that don't point directly at the CIA, the anybody but the CIA did it theory, because really I think they're all one theory. It's the don't look at me theory. You know, look at them, don't look at us. It has the effect of muddying the waters and making it hard for researchers to get through, and certainly confusing people like Lyndon Johnson. Over the years, he said things like the mafia, you know, might have done it. But in his later years, one of his top aides said LBJ came to believe that the CIA was behind the assassination. And I believe that's true, because he was not a dumb man. And a lot of people in Washington had that belief. They didn't all express it. But when David Talbot wrote his book, Brothers, he interviewed a lot of people, you know, from the D.C. power circles, and found that privately, they had all expressed doubts about the Warren Commission. They all knew that was bogus, but they weren't sure what the real story was, and a lot of them suspected the CIA. And the thing is, I mean, we can look at what's going on right now today with the Snowden affair. We've got this guy, Eric Snowden, who exposed the NSA as lying to Congress, as saying things that weren't true, and yet, you know, months later, there are no calls for a serious investigation of the NSA. Why is that? I think it goes right back to the Kennedy assassination. I think our elected officials are terrified of the intelligence community. If they could kill Kennedy and get away with it, then who are they? Congressman, senator? They don't want to be killed by the CIA. I honestly think our government has been broken since that moment in time, because people know. They say they don't know. They say we'll never know, but they know. They sense. They believe the CIA was capable of that. And that's why it's been impossible to have any effective oversight. We had this huge investigation of the CIA just before the House Select Committee, which we call the Church Committee and the Pike Committee, because the real names are much longer and hard to remember. But they went after the CIA, and they would get these guys called on perjury, but they wouldn't go any further. And when they tried to even get Richard Helms, they had him called on perjury. He lied and said the CIA wasn't involved in the coup in Chile, and they provably were, and it all came out. And even then, Helms was able to plead no contest, which is not quite the same as guilty or not guilty. It's kind of an in-between state. And he got off with a light fine. No one has ever served jail time for any of these huge intelligence abuses. And again, I think that's a direct legacy of the Kennedy assassination. And it's why, to me, it matters so much and it's so important, because if enough of us care, if there's enough of an outcry, collectively, we are more powerful than the intelligence agencies. Collectively, if we all demand that Congress do this or get voted out, they would take action. But unless there's that level of outcry, we're never gonna be controlling our government. And I say our government because I'm in America, but I would wager that other countries have these problems too, and maybe just not to the same degree. They didn't have an Allen Dulles and a John Foster Dulles who completely controlled foreign policy for so many years, maybe, in their country. But every country has an intelligence service. Every country has a media. Every country has a government. And those three things together form a very powerful trifecta that is hard to get past. And I wonder how democracy can survive when you have that kind of power concentrated in the hands of people who are provably willing to break the law to do what they think is right, regardless of what the law says. It's a very disturbing world to be a part of.
It is exceptionally disturbing, and I guess if there is any bright ray of hope in all of this, it's that more and more of the public are becoming aware of the invisible government and the way that it really does control the ostensible government, and at the very least, that awareness will delegitimize the system and some of the things that it's doing, and it's a question of whether or not that will be enough. There's so much more that I would love to talk to you about regarding Oswald and his story, and we didn't even really touch on what happened after the assassination. The killing of Tippett and his capture and Jack Ruby and
the three wallets.
Yes, right.
The three wallets. He left a wallet at home that day because he was going to kill Kennedy and he wasn't going to need it and he didn't want ID on him. But then he left another wallet at the Tippett shooting because I guess he forgot he had two. And yet there's a third one on him when he got arrested.
Funny how that works. Right. Well, a man who can dispense magic bullets can probably have three wallets.
Yeah.
Why not?
I want to talk about that just because there was a news special just on last night or the night before, and CBS reported on it in glowing terms. You know, there are these shows now that are coming out and saying new technology, new science proves now that the single bullet was possible. And I just want people to understand there's nothing wrong with the science. What's wrong is the input. You know, if you do a mathematical equation for statistics, for example, statistics is just math, so you think it'd be easy to do. But what makes it so hard is you have several different models. And if you choose the wrong model, your input will give you very different and incorrect results. And similarly with a math equation, you know, 2 + 2 is always going to equal 4. But what if the input shouldn't have been 2? What if the input was supposed to be 5? And you say, well, you know, 2 + 2 = 4. That's math. It's science. Perfect. It can't be wrong. But like I said, what if it was 5 instead of 2? And that was supposed to be 7, but no one knew because they didn't understand. So that's what they do with these TV shows. They put wrong input into good science and get a wrong answer. And that's how they get the single bullet theory to work. They paint a laser from the 6th floor window to a spot in the car. And then what they do is they just move the bodies around until they fit that laser instead of starting with where the bodies actually were and trying to draw a line through it. Now, they'll tell you these are the exact positions, but they're not. They're provably false. And at the conference, again, that I just attended or spoke at in Pittsburgh, which was a really good one. And by the way, the videos will be out, and I hope you can publicize them on your show when they're out, because it was the best conference I've ever attended, really quality speakers. Bob Groden actually had a picture from one of these TV specials that he showed me after his talk, you know, just because it came up. And he had a picture of the Kennedy car with the actual people in it and where their bodies were positioned. And then he had the same moment from one of these documentaries where the bodies were so clearly not in the right place. And he'd been a consultant on this show, and he had told the director, he's like, that's not where the bodies are. Look, I have every frame of the Zapruder film. I can tell you at any given moment in time where they were. And the producer didn't want to hear it because that was going to disprove the single bullet theory. So he just shunted that aside. One of the producers of these types of shows called me and tried to get me to be in one of his things. And I said, no. I said, I've seen your other documentaries. They're provably dishonest. He's like, what do you mean? You know, sometimes I wonder who's bamboozling who, you know, but that's
well,
how.
Even regardless of the ridiculous inputs that they put into these types of reproductions, I would pay good money to see anyone reproduce that shot, not only in the way that it went, going through 7 layers of skin, 15 inches of tissue, but then coming out, and 4 inches of rib, but then coming out in pristine condition, almost as if it had never even been fired on the stretcher in Parkland Hospital.
Right.
I mean,
have
just...
you seen the police do test bullet firings into water barrels. That bullet looks exactly like a bullet that was fired into a water barrel. If there are pictures of those, and people should just look them up online. That's exactly what it looks like. Now, I have one friend who's a shooter, and he claims he lined up a bunch of spare ribs, like 7, to simulate the 7 wounds. And I'm like, oh, come on, spare ribs. And, you know, that is not the same as a human body with numerous bones and, you know, the thick texture. Because he said he got a bullet that came out looking pretty much like that. But I just think his scenario was not a very credible representation. Yes. And the other thing was, everybody who saw the neck wound said it was an entrance wound. And all the doctors in Parkland, they believed Terry when he told them it was an entrance wound. And somebody just last week said, we all thought it was an entrance wound. You know, because again, a few of them had seen it, but the others who hadn't knew the credibility of the guy who had seen it and believed him. And, you know, it's so frustrating. Orwell wrote this wonderful thing. He said, freedom is the freedom to say 2 + 2 = 4. And that's what we have in this case. Like, they're now trying to, I don't know if you've read the press lately, they're almost trying to criminalize conspiracy theory talk. They're trying to make it sound like people's lives are lost by conspiracy theories. Like we're the problem. But it's sinister. It's really sinister that they want to raise the threat level on that and try and make it a crime to actually espouse a conspiracy theory. And there are some really ridiculous conspiracy theories. In fact, a lot of them are ridiculous. I mean, we have that whole birther theory that Obama wasn't born in America. That's just unbelievable. And it's funny, Kenya wasn't even Kenya at the time of Obama's birth. He literally couldn't have been born in Kenya. It didn't even exist. But never mind the truth, you know. So I understand there are hurtful, damaging conspiracy theories, but I would never ban any of them. I would rather expose them as the ridiculous, stupid theories they are, if that's the case. And the ones that aren't stupid, we need to grow up. Damn it. It's like we're just a bunch of innocents who want to believe in this fairy tale version of the world where everybody does the right thing and the American government stands for truth, justice, and freedom. You know, every kid grows up wanting to believe that. Now, most of us grow out of that. Most of us wake up and smell the coffee and realize, you know, there's a real world and not everybody's good and life isn't always fair and some people take advantage of the system and power and money trump everything. That's reality, and that's what the Kennedy assassination is. It's reality. I get very frustrated when, you know, people want to interview me to hear about my theories. It's like, I will show you facts. I don't care about theories. Let's talk the facts of the case. It's almost as if there can't be a fact about Kennedy, the way the conversation is framed these days. It's just shocking. So I thank you for what you're doing, because obviously you have a very serious interest and are willing to give people the time to talk and share what they know, and that is a hugely valuable service.
Well, I hope so. And in fact, under normal circumstances, since there is so much that we haven't yet covered, I would invite you back on in the near future before the 50th anniversary takes place to have another conversation. But as my listeners know, I'm going to be in France attending a conference next week, so I will not even be really posting to the website at the time of the 50th anniversary, which is too bad. But at any rate, I hope we will have you on at some time in the future to continue talking about this case and all of the various interesting aspects of it. One more time, perhaps you can give your website address and key details out for people who are interested.
Sure. And I definitely recommend follow me on Twitter. It's just Lisa Pease, run together as one word. My blog is realhistoryarchives.blogspot.com. And the book that I co-wrote and co-edited with Jim DiEugenio, it's a series of essays by me and Jim and others that actually focuses on most of the post JFK file releases. A really good book called The Assassination, so I highly recommend that. And again, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Lisa. And thank you to all of you out there for listening. And once again, I would ask you to bear with me as I'm trying to struggle to get things out before I head to France this weekend. So once again, please stay tuned to CorbettReport.com for all the latest. And of course, there you'll also be able to find the show notes for this interview, where you'll find the links to the various websites, Twitter feeds, and books that we've been talking about. Lisa Pease, thank you again for your time. And I'm looking forward to talking to you again in the future.
Excellent. Thank you. Bye-bye.